Chapter 14, Zionism. And then there was Balfour Day, the 50th anniversary of the famous declaration of British sympathy with Zionist aspiration, November 2nd, 1967. It was another day of national jubilance in Israel, and the Jerusalem Post carried messages of congratulations paid for by friends of Israel, from the ladies' garments workers of South Jersey and Philadelphia to the Plaza Hotel in New York, to private individuals like the Leo Lubbels of Texas, who wrote, "Hooray for a dream come true." A Christian minister in Ontario paid for a space to quote Isaiah 52:9. Quote, "Break forth into joy. Sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem, for the Lord hath comforted his people. He hath redeemed Jerusalem." A man in Virginia wrote, quote, "The victorious events of Israel accelerate the coming of the Messiah," end quote. Who that had stood at the Jaffa Gate on the evening of Simchat Torah would begrudge the Israelis this great happiness? With the knowledge of even the smallest part of the Jews' World War II sufferings, a smattering of the biblical prophecies, and some of the impressions that a visit to Israel can provide, it is easy to join in the rejoicing and congratulating. As I read over Balfour's loosely worded promise, it was hard to imagine any civilized country refusing to concur with it. Quote, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." End quote. But it was this promise which had led to the Arab-Jewish conflict. Until Zionism, a movement started in 1896 for the purpose of gathering Jews together from all over the world and recreating their national life in a homeland which would be their own, Arabs and Jews had lived together in relative harmony. So-called Arab-Jewish animosity is not, as is commonly believed, traditional. It is no older than Zionism. "Anti-Semites," Arabs said to me repeatedly, "how could we possibly be anti-Semitic? We are Semites." Seeing their country populated by an ever-growing number of Jews, however, they began to be uneasy, and tension built up until the partition of Palestine, which led immediately to the war in 1948. That war and the war of 1967 have finally gotten the Jews the thing they wanted above all else: all of Jerusalem. And it is reasonable to assume, if prophecy interests us at all, and I found that surprisingly few Jews were interested, that the June victory is what Isaiah meant by the, quote, redemption of Jerusalem. If this assumption is correct, then the expansion of Israel from the Euphrates to the Nile is also to be expected. Why not? Ask those who believe the Bible. And those to whom the Bible is nothing can watch this expansion with a shrug and say, "That's war. The Jews won it, didn't they? Or the Jews deserve it. After all, they've got to live somewhere, haven't they?" It was only very slowly that the painful questions began to dawn on me. Had Balfour's declaration been correctly understood? By, quote, "the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people," had he actually meant the establishment of Palestine as? The difference at the time probably would have seemed slight, and he did not foresee the tragedy of errors that would ensue. In effect, most of Palestine has been turned into a Jewish nation. Had the promise been kept? Balfour clearly said, quote, "Nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine," end quote. That the Arabs, who formed the majority should be mentioned only as non-Jewish was to them an exceedingly sore point. Churchill assured them, however, that the Balfour Declaration did not mean a Jewish government to dominate Arabs. Exactly who were these people for whom the homeland was being created? It had never once occurred to me until I went to Israel that that question, what is a Jew, had no simple answer. I kept coming across books and articles on the subject written by Jews. I heard the problem discussed in conversation. I began to ask the question of those I knew, and there was always a shrug or a slow and knowing smile and an attempt to reply. Ask two Jews, get three opinions, said one. The government of Israel has had to define a Jew in order to implement the law of return, which allows any Jew to immigrate to Israel at any time and automatically become a citizen. The best they have been able to do is reduce the question to the simplest possible terms. Who is your mother? Anyone is a Jew who is born of a Jewish mother. His father or his profession of faith will not help him at all. What, then, made his mother Jewish? To this question, there is no answer. Zionism's object is the return, or, quote, ingathering of the exiles. Who are these? By exiles, we must understand descendants of exiles from the Holy Land, and it would require a fairly nimble exercise in genealogy to establish the claims of present-day Jews to any blood relationship to those ancient Palestinians. The word return is hardly an accurate one if they were never there to begin with. Hitler based his argument against the Jews on race. The Germans were Aryans, the, quote, master race, which must be kept pure of Jewish contamination. No Jew had any rights as a German or a Pole or a Hungarian. He was a Jew, separate and distinct, and therefore deserving of segregation, labeling, and finally, of death. Anthropologically, the argument cannot be defended, for there are Jews in all the racial groups of the world. For example, Mongoloid, Caucasoid, and Negroid. It was a shock to me to realize that it is no more possible to identify a Jew by race than it is a Christian or a Muslim. The first Christians were nearly all Jews. Judaism was a proselytizing religion for hundreds of years after Christ, and during this time, many tribes of Europe embraced the Jewish faith and inherited all the Jewish claims, looking upon themselves as equally the, quote, chosen people. Many present-day Muslims, furthermore, are descended from Christians who are descended from Jews. They are of ancient Hebrew lineage, while many modern Jews are of European. What race, then, do the Jews represent? If the question, what is a Jew, is not a racial one, is it then a religious one? Many modern Israelis vehemently deny this. They are not religious. They are Jews, but not because of any belief in God. And if a non-Jew is persuaded of the truth of Judaism as a religion, he finds it extremely difficult to become an accepted convert. Judaism is not seeking converts, and Israel does not seek citizens who are not Jews. Even if a man commits himself to the Jewish faith against all discouragements, he is seen in Israel as a non-Jew. But the Apostle Paul, a Hebrew of Hebrews, would have offered little help toward a working definition of Jewishness. Quote, he is not a real Jew who is one outwardly, he wrote. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and real circumcision is a matter of the heart, spiritual and not literal. Again, Rabbi Samuel H. Dresner writes, quote, the haunting words of the prophet ring in our ears. You are my witnesses, saith the Lord, and I am God. Isaiah 43, verse 12. Is this not what we are being told by all the terrors of history and all the follies of man? Does this proclamation not sweep aside all our fumbling attempts to define the Jew, nation, race, or religion, and hold before us that divine demand which alone determines our being? I asked a Sephardic friend if the question could be answered linguistically. Quote, the term Semitic is, of course, only a linguistic one, and it designates a major group of languages of southwestern Asia and northern Africa. It includes both Hebrew and Arabic. It would not make much sense to say that he is a Jew who speaks Hebrew. Most of the world Jewry does not, and some non-Jews do. End quote. The founder of Zionism rejected racial and linguistic distinctions and at first urged upon Jews the importance of assimilation in the various cultures where they lived. But an increase in anti-Semitic feeling in Europe finally made Herzl reverse his stand, and he saw no hope for the survival of Judaism except in the opposite course, separation and isolation. He wrote his famous book, The Jewish State, in 1896, and later favored the suggestion that Uganda might be a possible location for the homeland. After his death, Zionists insisted that Palestine alone was suitable for the purpose, and a political movement was started to create a state with its own language and culture, distinct from all others, to which all those scattered Jews of the diaspora, as Zionism preferred to call all who did not live in Palestine, would be gathered together. Eleazar ben Yehuda revived the dead Hebrew language, and the Jewish consciousness was strengthened in every possible way. Zionism was, however, a purely political movement with no religious purpose, a point generally overlooked by those who see in it a kind of return to God. I asked a Jewish doctor of philosophy the question, what is a Jew? A Jew, he said, must be one who believes in his Hebrew heritage, which means, quote, that we are a suffering race and our revival is the result of our sufferings. It also means that we recognize our identity as one that will not mix. We have tried assimilation. Nazi Germany was enough to teach us that it will not work. We have tried ghettos. Zionism had to spring up to take us out of them. To be a Jew means that we have a culture, language, and aspirations of our own. And a Jew is one who must be willing to relive suffering and to find solutions to his problems. End quote. His definition leaves many questions unanswered. What is this, quote, Hebrew heritage? Does it mean the same thing to the Oriental Jewess in Arab dress that I saw at the Simchat Torah celebration, keening shrilly and lifting her arms in ecstasy, as it does to a Jew from New York's East Side, or to a Sabra born in a kibbutz? The exiles come to Israel from such a great variety of cultures that it would be difficult indeed to discover any common denominator in their heritage, even if they are religious. There are vast differences, I am told, in their ritual. Approximately half of Israel's Jews are, quote, Oriental, or belong to the group known as the Sephardim, a term originally designating those exiled from Spain in 1492, but now used to include all Arabic-speaking, Caucasian, and Bukharian Jewry. There has been strong feelings among them for years because they believe that they have been discriminated against in Israel's public life. Their society was much more traditional than that of Ashkenazim, the term which refers to the other large grouping, those from Central and Eastern Europe, who looked upon them as undemocratic, primitive, and incapable of assuming public responsibility. Any attempt, wrote I.A. Abadi in the Jewish Quarterly, to seek the common denominator in terms of either ritual or speech or outlook is bound to prove hopeless. As for my friend, the PhD's belief that assimilation simply does not work, there are many Jews in America who have found that it can. Are they then, according to his definition, not really Jews? Zionism has devoted much effort to convincing diaspora Jews that their responsibility is to go to Israel, or at least to give to it. A refusal to do either renders them unworthy in the eyes of Zionists of being called Jews. My friend's definition bypasses questions of race, religion, language, and politics. The condition that a Jew is one who is willing to relive suffering is a complex one indeed. Those who have suffered at their hands would call this claim a mockery. And we are reminded at once of what Christian claims looked like to the Jews during World War II. Before we allow our hoorays to reach too high a volume, whether because we take Isaiah's prophecies to have been fulfilled in our time, or because we believe Israel to be the hope of democracy for the Middle East, or simply because we generally like Jews, any of which may be a legitimate reason for hoorays, we must consider the painful questions, perhaps the most painful of which is whether or not there is any ethical basis for the existence of the state of Israel. Wherever sentimentality enters, it becomes nearly impossible to get at real issues. We have read books, seen films, and visited memorials which inform us of the suffering of the Jews. The cakes of soap and the torn Torahs disable us. To raise any serious questions about the ethics of Zionism is to arouse cries of anti-Semite or accusations of utter lack of human sympathy or sensibility. Few of us can face such charges. But the simple truth is that to have undergone a Holocaust or a crucifixion does not turn a person or a nation into saints. They are still human and must be granted the responsibility of humans. When God chose the Hebrews as a people to bear his name, he charged them with the responsibilities of privilege, to look out for the welfare of the stranger within their gates, to do justice to the foreigner, and warned them that his promises were contingent upon their obedience. Disobedience would reduce them to destruction, to slavery, and even, God said, to cannibalism. Deuteronomy 28. Martin Buber, the great Jewish theologian and philosopher, sought to prove the ethical basis for Zionism. If the Jews returned to Palestine, the land they loved, it would be of benefit to the whole world. They would fulfill the charge given them by God. The prophets of old had foretold a messianic kingdom in which peace and justice would reign, and Buber, along with others, saw the Zionist ideal as the beginning of this kingdom. The Arabs of today, the ones I talked with, have a very hard time seeing Israel in this light. They say, quote, "It is a state founded on force without the consent of the Arab. Palestinians have never been consulted on their attitude toward a Jewish state under the British, under the Jordan, or under Israel." End quote. It does seem odd that Palestinians have not been asked their attitude toward a Jewish homeland within their own borders. Not the British, nor the Jordanians, nor the Israelis have felt it necessary to ask their opinion. Most of the nations of the world found it advisable to recognize Israel. They may even have found it an easy decision. But perhaps it might have been a little more difficult had the homeland been projected within their own borders. Then, perhaps, the question of an ethical basis might have seemed relevant. A churchman with whom I talked in East Jerusalem said that Zionism could not possibly be construed as a theological or biblical question. It is a political and economic movement, and the Christian must consider it as such in terms of social justice, but must not introduce questions based on prophecy. Insofar, of course, as Zionism is a stage in the history of Judaism, insofar as it alters Judaism, it alters the kind of dialogue Christianity has with Judaism. And to date, there is almost no interest on the part of Israelis in such dialogue. It looks discouragingly as though Israel is making itself into a ghetto, as an Arab suggested to me. I attended a well-announced evening of Judeo-Christian dialogue in West Jerusalem. There were nearly 100 Christians present and 3 Jews, not one of whom was an Israeli. The center of prophecy is the coming of Messiah. Christians believe, of course, that he has come. But it was an old Jew, Simeon, and an old Jewess, Anna, both well-versed in Old Testament scriptures, who were the first to recognize him. The kingdom of Christ is the universal kingdom with no frontiers. All races, all nations of the world may be included in that kingdom. Israel, however, is dedicated to gathering in Jews. It is Jews and Jews only who are wanted, and almost daily the newspapers make a plea for immigrants to Israel. Aliyah, going up to Israel, is the desperate need, and methods are continually suggested for enticing Jews to come and settle. It is, of course, young Jews that are wanted. Israel has had a plethora of old ones, sick ones, indignant ones, who thronged in from countries where they had been second-class citizens. Therefore, quite understandably, Jews from the West with skills and talents to offer are diligently sought after. But how to get them? How, especially if they have not been second-class but first-class citizens, will they see Israel as a promised land? Would they be gaining or losing by going there? A professor from Dartmouth College suggested, in a letter to the Jerusalem Post, that Israelis had asked not too much, but too little. They had asked not for the heart, but for the money. Immigrants other than Jews, then, are not encouraged. Christians? Muslims? The fewer of these Israel has to cope with, the happier it will be. The Jewishness of the nation depends on keeping it as, quote, pure as possible, which idea has in it a loud and ominous echo. Ezekiel the prophet spoke of a new heart and a new way. The burden of all the Old Testament prophets was repentance, obedience, righteousness, and justice. May a prophecy be purely geographical? The return written of by the prophets is that of renewing a right relationship with God, not merely the going back to a geographical spot. The crucial issue lies here. Is justice possible in Israel? Rabbi Samuel H. Dresner wrote in the Jewish Quarterly, quote, "When Israel was locked in its ghettos and the Torah was its life and holiness its ways, Israel had something to say to the world. But the world did not ask them. Now the world is asking, and the question is, does Israel still have the power to speak?" End quote. A homeland was promised for a homeless people. Churchill and Balfour guaranteed that it would never be the cause of injustice to others. It was, at last, created, the age-long dream come true. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream, wrote the psalmist. But it is to those who have been most intimately and profoundly affected, who are also like those who dream, for they said to me, we are living in a nightmare. It is for those that the question must be put. Is there in Zion liberty and justice for all? Or, as Jeremiah asked long ago, run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, look and take note. Search her squares to see if you can find a man who does justice and seeks truth.